Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. The year-long conflict in Ukraine has reached a milestone, or inflection point, if you will, due mostly to three recent developments. The first is the Biden administration's ramping up of hostile rhetoric toward Russia. There are no policy changes, per se, accompanying this shift, but what we have, undeniably, is a coarsening of the way the U.S. administration is describing Russia's President Putin, ostensibly in response to the increased Russian offensive. It doesn't really mean anything materially, but it signifies a further departure from any path toward a diplomatic solution. Many would argue that no diplomatic solution is possible because Putin cannot be trusted, and there is cause to hold such a view, to be sure. But blame also rests with the U.S. for its insistence on a military outcome instead of negotiations, and with insistence on the disputed territory of Crimea that it be repatriated to Ukraine. The State Department and the UN do not mention Crimea outright much. They instead include it by implication when they use the coded term territorial integrity that respects Ukraine's established borders. That's the reference in the UN Security Council Special Emergency Summit this week as members consider a new proposed declaration. I have a copy of that proposal here, and it calls for military withdrawal by Russia, of course, that's a given, and one that I think nearly everyone supports wholeheartedly, as do I, and it calls for a settlement of non-aggression, the lawful treatment of prisoners of war, and the cessation of targeting of civilian and civilian infrastructure. That's the second development this week, and the third is Putin's unilateral withdrawal from the latest round of negotiations regarding nuclear weapons. That, in my view, is the most significant and most dangerous development. Critics of the war and the U.S. role, an odd assortment of whom gathered in Washington last weekend for a rally sponsored by the Trotskyist provocateur group Answer through one of its ever-rotating front groups, have called the U.S. posturing dangerous nuclear brinkmanship. And the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which publishes a warning in the form of a so-called doomsday clock, recently downgraded their prognosis, estimating that, in their metaphoric metric, the world is now 90 seconds from midnight, meaning that we're edging very close to nuclear Armageddon. There is discussion in the Russian media about the possible use of nuclear weapons, so the concern here is very real. But you can imagine, therefore, that many Russians are also very concerned about the possibility of Ukraine becoming a Western outpost, vis-a-vis NATO membership, because that would place long-range missiles and possibly nuclear warheads on the Russian border. Now, the critics of the U.S. role in all of this have been falsely portrayed as apologists for Putin. You listeners have enough information from this program and Democracy Now! And others to know that this is not true at all. We consistently oppose the Russian invasion, and in the scheme of things, Russia's motivations matter somewhat less than the enforceable solutions that could be achieved through negotiations. Putin may be a monster, but he may be constrainable. Russia may be at odds with the West on a number of geopolitical issues, but there's no reason to assume that the humane aspirations of Russian people for democracy and human dignity are any different from ours or those of most Ukrainians. In other words, there's common ground to be explored and recognized and nurtured that transcends the machinations of Eastern despots or Western imperialists. That, in turn, brings me to the rally over the weekend and my disappointment with the U.S. peace movement, such as it is, going back as far as the so-called Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which involved complaints about the legitimacy of national elections there. Much of the left of the U.S. sided with the anti-Russian elements in Ukraine, which in turn were covertly and later quite overtly sponsored by the U.S. There was, as many expected, a high degree of corruption in Ukraine, so it was a bit difficult to discern sides or right from wrong. But the existing white nationalist movement in Ukraine, which dates back to before the First World War, at least, and which has been growing lately, landed firmly in the anti-Russia camp. Even prior to the later election of pro-Russian President Yukashenko, himself an exponent of corruption without a doubt, there were occasional attacks of Russian-identified Ukrainians on Russian-identified Ukrainians in the eastern provinces and in Crimea by white nationalist militias whose openly stated goal was to expel Jews and Muslims and non-heterosexuals. There were occasionally reported in these were occasionally reported in the Western media outlets, but not given much attention. At the same time, it should be noted that Russia, under Putin, began some subtle interfering in Crimea, with an apparent interest in annexing it or bringing it thoroughly under Russia's sphere of influence. And that was both strategic and ideological in nature. But it wasn't until the electoral overthrow of Lukashenko that protests in Donbass and Crimea began to grow large and intense. Lukashenko was toppled by popular protests in the streets that were a coalition of pro-democracy, anti-corruption, and white nationalist elements. The U.S. lauded them as heroic, of course, and once the protesters surrounded the seat of government in Kyiv, Lukashenko fled into exile in Russia and was replaced by the governing council. The new administration rewrote the laws to legitimize the ouster, and armed reprisals against the pro-Russian protesters began in earnest. Of course, the attacks, mostly by the white nationalist Azov Battalion, which was incorporated into the Ukrainian National Guards and redesignated as a special force, were exaggerated in the Russian media, including some false reports of civilian massacres. But that does not mean that there weren't any such killings. The Lukashenko loyalists, too, were prone to violent attacks, and thus you had what the Western media described as a civil war. This also became the pretense for Russia's occupation of Crimea, which, as I mentioned, was both ideological and strategically motivated. But rather than an imperialist conquest, as Western outlets and the State Department ironically portrayed it, the occupation was the result of a complicated set of circumstances that included all of the factors I've described. Some in Crimea, perhaps a majority, saw the Russian occupation as a relief from the hostilities from Kyiv, while others felt it was an unprovoked aggression. But you never hear from Crimeans today being interviewed by Western media, and I find that troubling. There have been reports from neutral international organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch of some human rights abuses in Crimea, namely unlawful detentions, but not with the unusual frequency. There appears to be a no popular uprising in Crimea against the war or regret for the annexation. There is, however, a small but vocal anti-war movement within Ukraine calling for negotiated settlement and that recognizes Crimea as part of Russia, and which appears willing to concede conditional autonomy for the two Donbass provinces, two conditions that Zelensky initially entertained, but which the U.S. steadfastly rejects. Putin's popularity in Russia may be flagging a bit, but he appears to still enjoy majority support, despite the immense costs of the war. So if the U.S. strategy was to draw Russia into a quagmire, as we did with the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, it appears not to be working yet. This is in part because the world community isn't entirely aligned with the U.S. and its allies. Many African and Central American nations are remaining neutral, and some, like China, are continuing to trade with Russia, and the European Union countries, despite sending some military hardware and topically condemning the invasion, are continuing to purchase Russian oil and gas. The destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, which may have been perpetrated by the U.S. in a covert operation in cooperation with Norway, has certainly imposed hardships on the European countries dependent on Russian supplies. I don't think that the report from journalist Seymour Hersh constitutes proof or a smoking gun, but it certainly shows us a gun in proximity to smoke. The evidence is circumstantial, yet substantial, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if it were eventually verified. And back to an earlier point, the UN resolution declaring the annexation of Crimea illegitimate was as if along party lines, with nearly half of the voting nations abstaining or absenting or opposing. I wouldn't be surprised if the latest resolution isn't adopted by a sizable majority. In today's show, we'll hear again from Professor John Mersheimer, who is perhaps the leading advocate for the so-called realism school of thought regarding U.S. and Russia relations. You will note that he is in no way excusing Putin's actions, but attempting instead to offer a fuller, more nuanced assessment of things. Unfortunately, his prognosis for peace in the region is not particularly optimistic, but neither are the scenarios that stem from the presumption of either a Ukrainian or a Russian military victory.
Hello and welcome to Dialogue. As the Ukraine war approaches the one-year anniversary, the spillover effects of the conflict has been felt by people both on and off the battlefield. What's happened in the last year and how has this war changed the world? Looking beyond the Ukraine war, what kind of a world will we have? To help answer these questions, I'm happy to have on our show Professor John J. Mearsheimer, R. Vandell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of the Political Science Department at the University of Chicago. That's our topic. I'm Xu Qingduo. Welcome to the discussion. So, John, you know, flashing back to February 2022 when the war broke out, there were many debates about the causes of the war, factors leading to the war. Of course, a lot of finger-pointing and blaming at each other. And you are known in the Western world as almost the lone voice in blaming U.S. Obsession with the NATO expansion to Ukraine, which you pointed out for years has been viewed in Russia as a grave threat to its national security. Are you still holding that view?
Yes, I think the conventional wisdom in the West has long been that Vladimir Putin was an imperialist and he was determined to conquer Ukraine and make it part of a greater Russia, or he was interested in recreating the Soviet Union. There is no evidence to support that, and all the evidence indicates that he was fearful that the West was trying to make Ukraine a bulwark, a Western bulwark on Russia's border. And the principal element of the West strategy was NATO expansion into Ukraine. Putin and his advisors made it clear for many years that this was simply unacceptable. And if the West continued to push NATO eastward into Ukraine, there would be serious trouble. And of course, that's exactly what happened. And I have no reason to change my view, because if you look at people in the West and people in Ukraine who talk about the possibility of a peace involving Ukraine and Russia, they automatically focus on the subject of NATO expansion and the question of whether Ukraine can be neutral. That tells me that my basic argument from the start was correct, that this is really at its core all about NATO expansion.
Okay, NATO expansion now with 1 year past, almost past, about the war. So do you see a possibility still there for Ukraine, a membership for Ukraine?
I think it's extremely unlikely. And I think that what's going to happen here is that Ukraine is going to be turned into a dysfunctional rump state. And by that, I mean it's going to lose a big chunk of territory in its east. And furthermore, its economy is going to be wrecked. The Russians are in the process of trying to destroy Ukraine so that the remnant state that's left is so weak that it either cannot join NATO, or if it does join NATO, it's more of a problem for the alliance than it is an asset.
What about the continuity or continuation of military support from Washington, from Brussels, of tanks or even probably a fighter jet later on? And do you see any signs of fatigue, either on European countries or on the U.S. side?
I think that the West will continue to support the Ukrainians as much as possible. The West is deeply committed to this war. The view in the West is that the United States and its allies cannot afford to lose. So I think we will continue to give the Ukrainians as much military aid as we can. The problem that the West faces and the Ukrainians face is that what they really need is artillery. This is a war of attrition, and the key military system, or the key weapon that matters in a war of attrition, is artillery. And the Russians have a huge advantage in artillery. Some people estimate that the Russians have 6-to-1 or 7-to-1 more artillery tubes than the Ukrainians have. And the problem the West has, it doesn't have the artillery tubes and the artillery shells to give to the Ukrainians. This is why we're giving the Ukrainians armored vehicles like tanks and infantry fighting vehicles, because we don't have the artillery to give them. But the problem is that tanks are not a good substitute for artillery, and we're not giving the Ukrainians that many tanks. So all this assistance from the West doesn't really add up to that much. What is needed here is artillery. One final point on this, there's talk now, as you know, about the West giving the Ukrainians fighter pilots. The West giving the Ukrainians fighter aircraft that their fighter pilots can use. This is not going to help much at all. First of all, it's going to take a long time to train Ukrainian pilots to fly those F-16s or whatever Western planes are given to the Ukrainians. But the other thing is that the Russians have the most formidable air defenses in the world, especially weapon systems like the S-400. So I think even if the Ukrainians get some F-16s or other NATO aircraft, it's just not going to matter much. The fact is that they need lots of artillery, and they don't have that. And the war is not going good at this point in time for the Ukrainians as a result.
Mm-hmm. John, you said that the West is deeply committed to the war and they cannot afford to lose. But I would say probably it's the same for the Russians. They can't afford to lose the war. It's about their, you know, existence as a nation. So what's the final game? You know, and at the same time, you know, we heard of the talk of nuclear war. The threat seems to be increasingly, I'm not sure it's real, but there's a threat of nuclear weapons.
Well, I think there's no question that both the Russians and the West are deeply committed to winning this war. But I think that the Russians are more deeply committed. I think for the Russians, victory is more important than it is for the West. From a Russian point of view, what's happening in Ukraine is clearly an existential threat. They view it as a threat to their survival, and they have every intention of making sure that they do not lose, and indeed that they win this war. So you have here two sides that are deeply committed to winning, and the Russians are more deeply committed than are the Americans. What this tells you is, number one, that it's hard to see how you can have any sort of diplomatic settlement to this war, because both sides want to win, and it's impossible for both sides to win. This is why most people think this war is going to go on for a long time. Second, there is a possibility that the West and the Ukrainians will succeed in winning on the battlefield in Ukraine and pushing the Russians back. And it will then appear to the Russians like they are about to lose the war. In that instance, there is a non-trivial chance that the Russians will use nuclear weapons to rescue the situation. So one never wants to lose sight of the fact that there is always a serious possibility that nuclear weapons will be used in this war. And it is most likely that they will be used if the Russians are losing. So we in the West are in this paradoxical situation where we are trying to defeat the Russians in Ukraine. But the more successful we are at achieving that goal, the more likely it is that nuclear weapons would be used. And that, of course, would be an unmitigated disaster. We do not want that to happen. All of this just tells you how much trouble we are in regarding this war in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, we used to know that there's a basic theory of mutually assured destruction. If one party uses these nuclear weapons, the other party could do the same. And then that's destruction for both sides. Is that still, you know, working as a deterrent against either side?
Somewhat. But you want to understand that there are two different scenarios where nuclear weapons can be used. One scenario is where the Russians use nuclear weapons against NATO. And in that instance, mutual assured destruction comes into play, because obviously the West has nuclear weapons, the Russians have nuclear weapons, and there is a great danger in that situation that both sides would end up destroying each other. But the more relevant scenario at this point in time is where the Russians use nuclear weapons not against the West, but they use nuclear weapons in Ukraine against Ukrainian forces, and they use those nuclear weapons in a limited fashion. The Ukrainians do not have a nuclear arsenal of their own, so the Ukrainians cannot retaliate against Russia if Russia uses nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Therefore, mutual assured destruction does not apply in that scenario. And the Russians are likely to think that they can get away with using nuclear weapons. Now, one might say, if the Russians use nuclear weapons in Ukraine, the West will then retaliate with its own nuclear weapons to defend Ukraine. I do not believe that will happen. The French president, Macron, has said that that would not happen. So in a very important way, the great danger here is that the Russians are losing on the battlefield in Ukraine, and they use nuclear weapons in Ukraine, thinking that the West will not respond with nuclear weapons, and therefore we can avoid a mad situation.
Well, in any sense, we are going to see the tension, the situation continue to escalate before, we see an end scenario, either a peaceful negotiation or under whatever pressure, due to probably both sides, they are tired of fighting, then there will be a pause or stop.
I'm not sure about that. You want to remember that World War I went on from August 1914 until November 1918. And the number of people who were killed in World War I was very great. So it's not clear to me that this war will end anytime soon, because the two sides get tired of fighting. Again, you want to remember that for the Russians, they believe they're facing an existential threat. And when you think you're facing an existential threat, you in effect fight to the death. And the West is furthermore deeply committed to this war. So it's hard to see the West quitting, especially since Western soldiers are not involved. If anybody is going to get battle weary and think about quitting, it's not the West, it's the Ukrainians. And the Ukrainians, of course, view what's happening as an existential threat themselves. So the Ukrainians have a deep-seated interest in fighting to the death. So when you look carefully at this, it's very hard to see how it comes to an end unless the Russians begin to score major victories on the battlefield and the Ukrainian military collapses, or unless the Ukrainians begin to win on the battlefield and the Russians use nuclear weapons, in which case both sides would go to great lengths to shut the war down very quickly. But neither one of those two scenarios that lead to an end to the war look likely at this point in time. And what appears to be likely is that you're going to have a protracted war.
Mm-hmm. A protracted war. What about the effects of the war? You know, of course, we understand that there will be impact on the generations of the Ukrainians and the Russians, at least this generation. And of course, what about the effects on European countries? This is a war in the European continent, and the European countries are basically almost cutting their relationship with Russia. And what does the future be like?
Well, I think if you look at the consequences of this war for Europe, it's a very disturbing picture. I think that relations between Russia and Europe, and this includes not just Eastern Europe, but Western Europe, are now poisonous. Whereas the Russians and the Germans had had very good relations for decades. Russian-German relations are terrible. And there's no evidence that relations between Russia and the West are going to improve. And in fact, the Russians are going to have an incentive to cause all sorts of problems in Europe because they view the Europeans as their enemy. And the Europeans, of course, view the Russians as their enemy. So both sides are going to have all sorts of incentives to cause the other side trouble. And this means that it's hard to see how you're going to get a stable and peaceful Europe in the foreseeable future. Now, one very important element in the equation is whether or not you get a meaningful peace to end this conflict at some point in the not too distant future. I think it's more likely that you'll end up with a frozen conflict than with a meaningful peace treaty. So I think this conflict could lead to a situation where both sides stop shooting at each other, but the situation is not peaceful at all. And in fact, it looks a lot like the cold peace between North Korea and South Korea. And if that's the case, relations in Europe, stability in Europe are going to be in terrible shape for the foreseeable future.
For decades, probably. Not that long ago, you were at a debate about the solutions to the crisis. You talked about two alternatives. One is a neutral Ukraine. The other is to follow the Biden administration to double down on the sanctions on Russia. And tell us more about that, your choice in particular.
Well, I believe the only way out of this war and the only way to create any semblance of stability in Europe is for Ukraine to become a neutral state, for Ukraine to give up its aspirations to become part of the West, to give up on its aspirations to become a Western bulwark on Russia's borders. The Russians will accept nothing less. So if we want to end this conflict, we have to move to neutrality. A neutral Ukraine. But there's no evidence that's going to happen. It's unacceptable to the Americans. And instead, what the Americans and their allies are doing is they're doubling down at every turn. And this is why you see so much escalation in this conflict. The Americans are looking for ways to defeat the Russians in Ukraine and to badly damage the Russian economy. What the Americans are trying to do is they're trying to knock the Russians out of the ranks of the great powers. This, of course, is why, from Russia's point of view, what the West is doing represents an existential threat. And we do more and more every week to up the ante. And all this does is cause the Russians to do more and more to up the ante. So both sides are upping the ante more and more each week. You have this spiral mechanism at play. And in no way is this likely to lead to a neutral Ukraine, which again is the only way out of this crisis. So where this all ends at this point in time is hard to say, but it doesn't look like it's going to end up in a neutral Ukraine, and therefore it doesn't look like it's going to end up with a meaningful peace agreement.
Well, some say we are moving to a multipolar world, and of course with Russia basically defying the U.S. will and the rise of the rest, let's say, if you look at the global south, China, India, South America, Brazil, basically countries in the developing world, they are not following the Western countries to impose sanctions on Russia. And then they refuse to take sides on the war. And so they are choosing a neutral status in terms of the Ukraine conflict. Do you see the rise of a multipolar world? If that's the case, what's the impact of the war on the global order?
I think there's no question that we are in a multipolar world. I believe we have been in a multipolar world since roughly 2017. And when I say we're in a multipolar world, I believe there are three great powers on the planet, the United States, China, and Russia. I believe Russia is the weakest of those three great powers. And I believe that China is a peer competitor to the United States. One does not want to underestimate how powerful China is and how much potential power it has. And this is why the United States has long been interested in pivoting to Asia. So you have three great powers at play in the system. We are in a multipolar world. Unipolarity is behind us. Now, given the Ukraine war, what's happened here is that America's ability to win friends around the world has diminished. It's really quite remarkable. There's no question that in the West, relations between the United States and its European allies and relations between the United States and Japan and South Korea have improved as a result of the Ukraine war. And the West looks more united than ever. But given what the United States is doing in Ukraine, it's quite clear that outside of the West, most countries are not sympathetic to the United States at all. And in fact, they're reasonably, if not very, hostile to the United States. I think the best example of this is India. Before the Ukraine war, it looked like India and the United States were going to join together to form a quite tight balancing coalition against China. But once the Ukraine war broke out, given the history of good relations between Russia and India, the Indians have been very reluctant to side with the United States in any meaningful way against Russia. And indeed, one could argue that the Indians are siding with the Russians against the Americans over the Ukraine war. This has ramifications for the United States' ability to contain China, because India was supposed to be a key player in the balancing coalition against China. So if you look at what's happening as a result of the Ukraine war, what you see is that outside the West, the United States is not doing very well in terms of winning influence and getting countries to line up on its side against China.
Well, you said the U.S. is not doing that well in winning friends. What happened, you know, because the Trump administration certainly is gone and we have the Joe Biden administration here?
Well, the fact is that the Biden administration is, I think, on balance, somewhat more aggressive and somewhat more hawkish than the Trump administration was. Donald Trump, for all his faults, was not a warmonger. Donald Trump did not start any wars. He makes the argument, and it may be true, that if he were the president instead of Joe Biden, that there would be no war in Ukraine. We can never know for sure whether that's true. But it does get at the point that Trump was, he was certainly hawkish towards China, and he was certainly interested in containing China. There's no question about that. But other than his policy towards China, he was not remarkably hawkish by any means. Joe Biden, on the other hand, is hawkish across the board. He is very interested in pursuing an aggressive foreign policy. And by the way, if you look at American policy on Ukraine from January 2021, when President Biden moved into the White House, up until when the war broke out in February of 2022, what you see is that Joe Biden was becoming much more aggressive on the Ukraine issue than Trump had been. And it was Biden's aggressiveness on the Ukraine issue that played a key role in leading to the war breaking out on February 24th of last year. So you do not want to underestimate how aggressive Biden was toward Russia on the Ukraine issue. And of course, he's been every bit as aggressive towards China, if not more aggressive toward China than his predecessor, Donald Trump, was. So it's just important to understand that even though Trump is gone, the United States has not become less aggressive on the foreign policy front.
Mm-hmm. What about Russia, John? You know, Russia, obviously, they are having probably less and less relationship with the European countries, which they previously enjoy a lot in terms of trade. But now they are turning to Asian countries, for example, or Africa. So in a couple of years, now they are quite weak economically because of the sanctions. What about, you know, in 3 years' time or in 5 years' time? Are their relationship with China, India, other Asian countries going to, replace or at least fill this the empty room, you know, left probably in their relationship with the European countries?
I think that has to happen. It's hard to imagine trade relations between Russia and Europe going back to what they were before the war broke out. And that's especially true of German-Russian relations. It is possible that those relations, those trade relations, will improve somewhat in the distant future. But I think it's going to take a long time for that to happen. And in the meantime, the Russians have very powerful incentives to replace their trade relations, their lost trade relations in Europe, with increased trade relations with countries like India and countries like China and countries in places like Africa. And you see much evidence of that already happening. And I think you'll see more of it moving forward. You know, there's a great deal of talk in the West about the fact that sanctions have failed. There's no doubt that sanctions have hurt the Russian economy somewhat, but not very much, nowhere near as much as people expected. And one of the reasons for that is that the Russians have been able to replace their trade relations or their trade with the West, with trade with other countries, to include China and India.
So, you know, the latest news being that the U.S. bombed this Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Will that have any effect on Washington's relationship with Brussels?
I don't think so. I think the key question is whether or not it will have an effect on U.S.-German relations, because Nord Stream belonged to the Germans and the Russians, not to Brussels. And the question is, what will the Germans do? It's, you know, difficult to say for sure, but my guess is that the Germans will complain somewhat. But in the end, the Germans will not complain too much, because the Germans are in good part subservient to the Americans. The Americans basically call the shots in Europe. And when you're involved in a war over Ukraine and the Germans are allied with the United States against Ukraine, and when the United States provides security for Germany, you have a situation where there are real limits to what the Germans can do in terms of complaining about the whole Nord Stream experience. So I don't think it's going to matter that much in the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, we conclude today's show. Many thanks to Professor John J. Mearsheimer. You can also find us on the CGTN app on YouTube. I'm Xu Qinduo. Thank you for being with us. See you next time.
Last week was the annual march for Oak Flat, a relatively pristine, high desert riparian area east of the Phoenix Central Valley in Arizona, under threat of complete destruction if a proposed copper mine is allowed to proceed. I'm about 45 miles from there at the moment, but couldn't attend the event due to my work schedule. I hope to get to Globe and the San Carlos Apache Nation to speak with the organizers next week or soon to get an update, but just a recap, the Oak Flat area was traded to a British and Australian mining conglomerate by then-Senator John McCain in exchange for a few random real estate holdings elsewhere in the state that are not considered significant in terms of either habitat or public popularity. The mining company, Resolution Copper, is a subsidiary of the notorious Rio Tinto Mining Company that has a long record of safety and environmental violations, including the destruction of protected historic sites. The proposed mine in Arizona would be one of the largest of its type in the world, and while not quite an open-pit mine, which comes with an obvious toll of environmental destruction and public health hazards, the mine would create a huge pit where the Oak Flat campground and waterway that is sacred to the San Carlos and Diné people now exists. Recently, a longtime resident of the town of Superior, which sits just downstream from Oak Flat, spoke out against the mine.
My name is Henry C. Munoz, Sr. I'm a former underground miner here from Superior, Arizona. Born and raised here. Spent half of my life working in underground mines. Cut and fill here in Superior and block cave mining in San Manuel for a total of 23 years. And I currently still reside in Superior, Arizona. My fight is for my community, for the community's water. Because once we destroy this, there's no going back. It's irreparable damage. You know, there's nothing you're going to fix here once they destroy it. And once they destroy it, water being the main blood of any community or any forms of society, once that's gone, your town's going to be completely destroyed. There's nothing you can do to change it. It's going to consume 40,000 acre feet of water a year. That amount of water is what the city of Tempe currently uses with a population of 160,000 people. Everybody in Arizona should be concerned and take a firm stance against this project, which is going to leave a crater 2 miles wide and 1,000 feet deep. Okay, you could stick the Eiffel Tower on the bottom of this pit and you still won't be able to see the top. So that shows you the magnitude of destruction that's going to take place. And there's no turning back. Once you destroy it, you just can't go back and bulldoze over it and fill it up with dirt or what have you. The other part of it, the environmental damage is going to cause, is the tailing site. Over approximately 5 billion tons of toxic tailings that are going to be disposed of approximately 12 miles south of here. And the potential for tailings failures, Rio Tinto and BHP have been known throughout the world to have tailings failures, where tailings have collapsed and flooded areas and contaminated and killed individuals in other countries. These two foreign mining companies, Rio Tinto out of England, BHP out of Australia, once they make their money and send their profits to their prospective countries, what do we have left? All we're going to have left is the wayside dump, you know, with the tailings south of us, 12 miles on the other side of Hayden. You know, they're going to have that to contend with. And there's no guarantee that this mine is going to pay us any money if they destroy our water in the first place. The type of mining they're using is called block cave mining. This mining has never been used in this area. It was used in San Manuel, Arizona, where they had a block cave mine over there. And that's where I worked for 13 years in the block caving method. Once I found out that they were using the block cave method over here, the hairs on my neck stood up and I said, you know, you're going to use that here where we traditionally have used cut and fill. The big difference between the block cave and the cut fill is the cut fill was basically going to the dentist, getting the tooth drilled out and having it refilled. That's the same type of mining technique we were doing here in the past. That was grandfather's mine there, you know. But now with block cave, basically what you end up is with a funnel, a crater, 2 miles wide and 1,000 feet deep. The sad thing is that this block cave mining is going to destroy both our deep ground and our shallow ground aquifers. That came out in the FEIS, the study, the 4 to 6 year study that was conducted by the U.S. Forest Service at a cost of $4 million. What's ironic is that Resolution Copper paid for that report. Subsequently, they asked for a review of that FEIS, and the Bureau of Land Management came in last year and did a critique of it. And their studies show that a lot has changed since 2014. Here we're in 2023. Drought had gotten worse. A lot of your aquifers have been depleted. Population growth explosion in Arizona. And the mere fact that this is going to destroy probably one of the most vital suppliers of water to the East Valley. The copper itself, the ore, it's going to be refined and it's going to be shipped to China to be processed. See, a lot of people don't know that Rio Tinto is owned, 15% is owned by Chinalco. Chinalco is based in China. They own 15% of Rio Tinto. They're going to send their byproduct down to the Sea of Cortez, down in Guaymas, and they're going to ship it by boat to China, where it's going to be processed, and then it's going to be sent back to us, sold back to us, which makes no sense. It's an American product, but then again, it's going to do foreign countries to be sold back to the American. And the person that's going to be hurt is the American taxpayer. He's going to be left with the cleanup costs. Copper is an abundant resource, mineral resource. It can be smelted and refined and smelted again and recycled. It's got it can be done endlessly. You can smelt it forever. It never breaks down. It becomes copper all again. And you can recycle it forever. The funny thing is that we have a mine in San Manuel, Arizona, where I worked for 13 years. They shut that mine down. They demolished the smelter, which probably was one of the cleanest burning smelters in the United States. And they left 30 years of ore underground in San Manuel. Why don't they go over there and open up that mine? That mine lost 3,300 people just with a blink of an eye. The town's totally economically depressed. It wouldn't hurt them to go back and open up that mine again. That they used the Block Cave mine over there. Why not go over there and get those 30 years of copper left underground over there? That's an issue I brought up to the CEO, Jacob Strapo, when I was in England last year. And he didn't even have an answer for it, you know. But there's copper resources in different areas that aren't as environmentally sensitive as these, where you're not going to destroy your community's water. You know, you're not going to create a 2-mile-wide crater, you know, in the middle of an aquifer, you know. So there's other avenues that they could look at. And as for being a critical mineral, copper is abundant everywhere. All we have to do as a society is focus on recycling. There's a lot of copper that's thrown into waste field sites that can be recycled, but they just don't do that. An old fable that they always throw out, jobs, jobs, jobs. I worked here in this mine behind me for 10 years. It shut down in 1982. 1,300 people in our community were displaced. Even though the company came out and told us on a Friday, don't worry, these rumors the mines are gonna shut down, they're just rumors. But by Monday, we were told to turn in our equipment. So we were left without a job. Okay, the same thing happened to me at their sister company in San Manuel. We were told on a Friday, hey, don't worry, these rumors of the mine shutting down and are just rumors. Don't worry about it, we'll never shut this place down. So lo and behold, on Monday, we're marched out of the mine by the Pinal County Sheriff's deputies and escorted to the change room and to turn in our equipment. So this promise of jobs, 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 over there, 3,300 people were laid off. They no longer had jobs, and it hasn't opened up to this date. That's since 1999. So this story that jobs are going to be forever, no. Jobs are only guaranteed for that day. Arizona makes more money on tourism, recreation, and camping and hunting, such as visiting beautiful areas like this, that we should invest in tourism. As a council member for 10 years, that was our goal. We invested in tourism in our community to bring people into our town, to visit places like the Oak Flat campgrounds, to go and visit the other camping areas and hiking areas, to go out four-wheeling, mountain climbing. Now with resolution coming in, they've came with the same philosophy, you know. We're gonna get into all the organizations, we're gonna pump money into them, give them money, our schools, our Little League, our Chamber of Commerce, even with our city, our town council. They entered into an agreement with the city approximately 2 years ago, where the town was looking at a purchase of the old high school and use it as a multi-generational center. The cost of the old high school, it had some improvements done by a private resident, and it was selling for the tune of $4 million. Well, the town secures $2 million of federal CDBG grants. And Resolution Copper tells the town, hey, we'll give you the other $2 million on one condition, that you do not annex any of our town properties. And if you do, then you have to pay us back those $2 million. It's in the government to Resolution a contract agreement. So basically, they're not giving us $2 million. They're telling us they're going to give it to us on the condition that we don't annex any of their properties. In other words, they don't want to pay their fair share of taxes, you know, because being that the town's not within, the mine not being in the town's annex area, they're exempt from taxes going to our community. So the FEIS noted that it wasn't in the annexed area. So why does a big company, two big companies, two of the biggest in the world, have to pull a card, you know, from under the table, a playing card, and say, hey, you know, you have to abide by our rules, you know, or you're not going to get these $2 million, you know. So essentially, they're not giving us anything. They're basically bribing us, telling us, hey, we're going to give you this on one condition that you don't do this. So the economic boom to the town is not in mining.
Well, in Ohio, we have our own environmental disasters aplenty, and the recent train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, illuminated the problem. The Ohio EPA responded with testing of air and water in the area after the toxic chemical spill and fire contaminated a large area and forced evacuations of about half of the residents there. The Ohio EPA quickly asserted that to everyone that there was no public safety or health concerns, but advised folks to rely on bottled water for a while, you know, just in case. The conditions on the ground, as described by returning residents, seemed to starkly contradict the Ohio EPA's assessment, and many people expressed doubts about the agency and about Governor DeWine's handling of the spill by Norfolk and Southern Railway. U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, who has seldom heard from except when disappointing railway workers striking over railway safety concerns, finally made a trip to East Palestine more than 3 weeks after the spill. I covered the issue in last week's show and hope to have more in later editions. And we have some later breaking news about another potentially problematic environmental mishap, this time in Tennessee, at an area known as Oak Ridge, the town that was grabbed by the Pentagon through eminent domain and converted to a uranium processing facility to serve the U.S. nuclear weapons program. This week, there was apparently a fire in a uranium enrichment facility at the Oak Ridge campus. Here's a local report.
We are turning back to that breaking news situation out of Oak Ridge. Officials say there was an emergency at the Y-12 National Security Complex this morning around 9 a.m., and we're told it was a fire involving uranium. Right now, there's no off-site impact, and officials also say no injuries were reported, and we also just learned that all employees have been accounted for. We want to go out live to WATE 6 on Your Side reporter Molly O'Brien. She's out in Oak Ridge right now. Molly, what can you tell us?
Yeah, Lexi, like you said, good news. There is no threat to the public. But what I can tell you is crews responded to a fire involving uranium in building 9212, which is actually on the west side of the complex. Workers were eventually evacuated. There were a couple hundred workers, and they put a shelter in place. Now, what I can tell you is all employees have been accounted for. No injuries were reported at this time. And like I said, that fire involved uranium. The protocols to put out in fire involving uranium is different at this time, or is different right now. We asked officials what that looks like. Here's what they had to say.
That building does uranium processing for all of our uranium-based missions. As the Uranium Center of Excellence for the NNSA, we process materials in support of nuclear Navy mission as part of non-proliferation and as part of our classical NNSA mission. So there's a lot of different forms of material there.
Now, good news so far. Those air monitors show no chemicals have been released, meaning there's no radioactivity. Of course, officials will keep following up and monitoring this. As of what caused the fire, that investigation is still ongoing. We, of course, will keep you updated. Reporting live in Oak Ridge, Molly O'Brien, WATE 6 on Your Side.
All right, Molly, thank you so much. And we are going to continue to follow this story throughout the day, bring you developments as we learn more information, especially on the website on WATE.com. Make sure you have our news app as well. And of course, in our afternoon and evening newscast.
My guess is that story will blow over with minimal fallout, entendres intended. We'll hope to, I hope you'll intend to join us again next week at this time for another edition of Conscious Voices here on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I also encourage you to give what you can for our Antenna Relocation Fund. You can go to WCRSFM.org and make a contribution of whatever you can there. It will help us to move the antennas for both stations to new facilities, which is a necessity at this point, and we hope to have better coverage of the Columbus area as a result. It is an expense, though, and we do need your help. So I'll see you all again next week at this time for another edition right here. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.